If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
The optimism was something that really surprised me when I was doing my research, because when we think about POWs, we often think about those gates slamming shut behind them and these men facing an endless number of years, not knowing when freedom would come, but that it would be a long time coming. And we particularly think of that mindset with the men who were captured at 1940 in France and Belgium. What I found was completely different.
That was Claire Makepeace discussing British prisoners of war.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. In today's episode, you'll hear an interview with the historian Dr. Claire Makepeace, whose most recent book, Captives of War, explores the stories of Britons who became prisoners of war in Europe during World War II. She spoke to our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Your book, Captives of War, is concerned with how British prisoners of war in the Second World War in Europe made sense of their wartime imprisonment. And you're concerned with the way in which their captivity was psychologically experienced. So perhaps you could just introduce us to the accounts that you investigated during the writing of this book and a few of their varied experiences.
Absolutely. So my book focuses upon 75 POWs, and these men were from all three branches of service, captured at different times of the war. And I chose them because of the personal narratives they had written during captivity, the letters, diaries or logbooks they had kept. And logbooks were sort of akin to scrapbooks that POWs kept in captivity. And I wanted to use the sources that gave me the most access to these men's inner and intimate worlds. And so I came up with this group of 75 POWs. And we explore their mindset through their writings from capture, how they responded to being captured, throughout wartime imprisonment. And because I'm focusing on the emotional dimension of captivity, I look at themes that historians haven't really discussed in great detail before, such as POWs' relationships with loved ones at home, which comes up time and time again in their letters and diaries. I look also at their relationships with each other, the mental disturbances that tore through their minds, and how they made sense of being under the power of their enemy at a time of war.
You explore in some of the early accounts the optimism that fills many of the recordings during early imprisonment, yet you found that that kind of hardened as the war continued.
Yes, the optimism was something that really surprised me when I was doing my research, because when we think about POWs, we often think about those gates slamming shut behind them and these men facing an endless number of years, not knowing when freedom would come, but that it would be a long time coming. And we particularly think of that mindset with the men who were captured at 1940 in France and Belgium. What I found was completely different. I found the most incredible optimism held by POWs, and they envisaged the war ending in days or weeks or months in the context of the Allies winning the war. And one great example is Captain Mansell, who writes in his diary in April 1941 how one of his fellow POWs is by far the greatest pessimist he's ever met, because he's putting September 1942 as the end of the war. Another POW, Captain Angove, wrote in December 1944, "I'm now going to start asking for chocolate and books to be sent from home, because I've been expecting that I'd be released before they'd ever arrive, but now I'm just going to sort of stay the course and see what happens." And as you said, it's as the war progressed that optimism subsides, but it really only subsides, ironically, in the final months of the war, when the end really is coming.
You write about the accounts that you found of letters and parcels that POWs received from home. What did you find about the connection or the disconnection that this gave to the men?
I really loved writing on the relationships between POWs and their sweetheart, their wives and their mothers and fathers. It's something that isn't covered really in other history books. It doesn't really feature in films, and it isn't discussed at all actually in the POW memoirs I've looked at. But loved ones at home were such an important part of the captivity experience. Letters and parcels that arrived into the camps were seen as sort of proxies of those loved ones. As bombardier Stuart Campbell describes his wife's letters as breaths of hope and home. Driver Glass, when he opened up the parcel from his mother, he loved it so much because his mother had been the last one to touch those items, so it sort of provided a physical connection. And POWs also, in their fantasies, would drift back to Civvy Street. So this idea that POWs sort of were far away in some sort of barbed wire vacuum isn't a correct understanding of their mentality. They would go back to their loved ones, particularly on a Sunday when they could envisage what they were doing, because that's the day they would often spend with them. Captain Angove would board a magic carpet from his POW camps in Italy and Germany to go back, fly back and see his mother and sister to escape from the confines of his camp. And they were so, these were so important that POWs actually put them on a par to physical food, which is significant for men whose lives were dominated by hunger. So they spoke of letters feeding the spirit as no food can. In that instance, they're even more important than food could be. But there was a negative to this, because having loved ones at home was a great source of support, but also reminded POWs of their potential inadequacies. So I talk about, in my book, about the three P's of masculinity: provider, protector, and procreator. And these were all denied to POWs. They couldn't protect their families. Major Matthews, one of the imprisoned medical officers I mentioned earlier, he wrote of how he was humiliated beyond words, that his wife and his children were the ones who were now exposed to bombing while he was so far away from the front line that a blackout wasn't even necessary. These men couldn't provide for their family. Instead, their families were providing for them, by sending them in parcels. And they often, when they open these parcels, they compare themselves to children at Christmas. So they've reversed that relationship from sort of fatherly provider to filial dependent. And they didn't have access to women, so they couldn't fulfill that role of procreator. Lieutenant John Phillips writes about how he was in monastic seclusion when he's writing to a lady that he had hoped to eventually marry.
You consider how a lot of them react to their capture, and you find that some of them may experience guilt or kind of emasculation at that point.
Yes, that's correct. Two things were stressed really heavily in the diaries I looked at when POWs wrote up about their account of capture. One, they were keen to emphasise their helplessness in battle. And they often did this through animal metaphors. So Lieutenant William Bombus, who was captured in Tunisia, he lost his revolver and he wrote of how he came like a lamb to the Germans. The other thing they stress is that they had no choice. They envisaged being wounded, they envisaged being killed, but never envisaged being captured. And Corporal Eric Barrington does this brilliantly in his diary. He has a 16-page account of capture. And on three different occasions, he really emphasises, I thought I might be killed. I thought I was prepared to be wounded, but never did it cross my mind I'd be captured. And I think both these things illustrate how for POWs, capture was not automatically seen as a dishonourable thing, but it would be dishonourable if it had been sort of a chosen outcome. So as a result, these men really stressed that they just had no other choice than capture being the end result of their battle. I think the strongest feeling was the feeling about being apart from loved ones. That for me was the dominant emotion that came through, the dominant concern. And actually, one of my conclusions of my book is that these men were civilians first and foremost before they were sort of combatants. They express in great detail how they miss their loved ones, how they want to be with them, but also one wonderful thing is how they conceive of the war ending in time for them to attend the next familial event, so the next birthday or anniversary. So I love the way in which they telescoped a global war right down to the most intimate of family occasions. So that was a really, really strong feeling. In terms of their relationships with each other, unsurprising, one comes across very, very close friendships that existed between POWs. And these were beautifully captured often through drawings in the logbooks or even poetry. And one comes across how irritating these men found being in constant company with others. And this is one of the things I loved about the diaries. We think of diaries as recording experience, you know, writing down what happened. But in this instance, diaries could in turn shape the experience. So Captain Mansell often used his diary to just vent his frustration with some of his fellow POWs and how irritating he found them. And he'd you know, get an awful lot off his chest by writing in his diary what he actually thought of these men. And he could never say that to their faces. But that in turn shaped the experience of captivity because it made communal living more bearable. In terms of how POWs felt at being sort of subservient to their enemy, interestingly, the dominant theme that came up was how they felt they were actually the superior to their enemy. There's universal superiority of the British compared to the Italian captors. They, as a nation, the British felt they were far better. And many POWs were very, very insulted at the idea that on their forms, it was written down that they'd been taken prisoner by the Italians when many had been taken prisoner by the Germans and then handed over to the Italians. But in relation to the Germans, in interesting ways, they claim that they're in a better position than their guards or the equal to their guards. And that can be done, that's even done through examples of cooperation, where they put themselves on a par with their guards when they sort of give their parole, and both the guards and the POWs find that beneficial for the setup of the camp.
And you mentioned the hierarchy there of the British putting themselves, you know, as the top, if you like. But how did the military hierarchy transfer into the camps?
That's a good question. And rank didn't come up as much in the sources as I anticipated it would. And that's, I think, primarily because POWs were segregated after they'd been captured. And officers were sent in one direction and held in camps for officers or compounds specifically for officers. And other ranks were sent to different camps. So the two didn't really witness what the other were being made to do, and other ranks by and large were made to work very hard for the Third Reich and for their Italian captures, particularly in 1943. Officers were protected by the Geneva Convention of 1929 from being made to work. But one place where you can see rank played out is through the batmanning system. So even though we're at war and we're in POW camps, officers were allowed batmen, and there were about 10% of the OFLAG population in Germany, the camps for officers, about 10% were made up of other ranks. And in some cases, it's quite clear that that is holding up strongly. And one example of this is actually at Christmas time, when a couple of the officers wrote about how they waited on the other ranks at Christmas dinner. And one might think of that as an inversion, but it was actually a way of shoring up the military hierarchy. There are other examples where officers just bemoan how the other ranks are just doing their own thing. They're getting paid to work for officers, but they're doing none of their duties, and they're having to fill in on all the chores, and they're not impressed by that.
Once they're in the camps, you examine how an identity almost formed around the men in the camps, and you call it a Kriege identity. Can you tell us a bit about how this was forged, what you mean by that term?
Yes, I was struck, particularly reading these logbooks, and these logbooks are utterly beautiful sources. I urge anyone to have a look at them if they're at the Imperial War Museum. The YMCA sent them out to POWs in the last year of the war, and they're encouraged to use them for drawings, for writings, for poetry, all sorts of different things. And some things were being repeated time and again in these logbooks. So the men often were drawing maps of their camps. They were pasting in the camp money they were handed out. Some contained their parole forms and identity papers. And others record a language that arose amongst prisoners of war, this a Kriege language, where they have their own particular slang, and then they're explaining to the readers who will eventually come to look at these logbooks what those words and sentences mean. And I felt that these men were sort of forming a particular identity around being prisoners of war, sort of a positively acknowledging that particular status and the very particular life that they were living in the camps.
What other factors did you find that bonded them? There was, I think, a fear that wives may have been straying at home.
This comes up an awful lot in the logbooks, and there are copied out snippets of letters written by people at home that are actually quite rude or offensive to POWs and really show a gross misunderstanding of the hardships that these men went through. And these are written up time and again, and often it's the same quote that comes up in logbooks written by men in completely different camps. So there seems to be sort of rumours circulating. And they don't just write these up, they often beautifully decorate the page that contains them, which shows that they feel strongly about these snippets and the things that are coming into the camps. And I concluded that they illustrate POWs bonding around people outside the camps, misunderstanding their life within it. And although there was the negative thing of people at home, you know, not knowing the hardships these men went through, not appreciating the fact that they weren't able to even get out of the camps, these men took that and it became a form of therapy to sort of copy those out and discuss it.
I suppose for many people, when they think of prisoners of war in Europe in the Second World War, their first thoughts may go to the events depicted in The Great Escape. And you consider more sort of acts of insubordination or rebellion and how these function psychologically for the men who were in these camps.
I don't look at escapes because I draw upon the diaries and letters and logbooks that were written during captivity. And POWs couldn't talk about the really illicit activities that were going on in case those diaries were seized, the letters were being censored as they left the camps, so the guards would find out about those activities. But what I do is discuss the, as you say, the smaller acts of insubordination and through these, how POW sort of maintained a self-respect, but also in a way empowered themselves and took hold of things that the Germans or Italians intended to oppress them and actually used them to sort of boost up their confidence or boost up their morale. One example is a reprisals episode that happened. So there were 9 reprisal episodes that happened during the course of the Second World War between Italy, Germany and Britain. And these were sort of tit-for-tat episodes where the Germans claimed that the British were mistreating its prisoners. And as a result, the Germans then withdrew a privilege, or not necessarily a privilege, but a basic living condition in some cases from the British POWs. And in this one instance in 1942, some British POWs found themselves with their personal possessions removed, including their razors. And Major Castagli was involved in this. And he writes of how in the camp, men responded to that by having beard competitions, who could grow the longest beard, who could grow the silkiest one. And through that, they kept the morale high. And it's a lovely example. It's not a great act of rebellion. It's not a dramatic act of rebellion, but it's a smaller example of the insubordination that these men would embark on sort of a more everyday basis.
You consider
this episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
The presence of female impersonators or men in drag within the camp. What was the reaction within the camps to this?
Female impersonators were a common sight in the main POW camps, those camps that held officers or the sort of the non-working POWs. And they often appeared on stage. And if you see, there are some photos in my book, there are lots of photos out there on the internet, they're incredible. And dressed in stunning outfits, very female-like. And in the diaries and letters, POWs very strongly stressed how similar these female impersonators, how good they were at impersonating women. Sometimes they even say that they're better at being women than women themselves, and women will learn something off them, which I think is an interesting example of the dominance of the gender hierarchy when men are claiming their superiority by being better women than women can be. But aside from that, the POWs were also very readily discussing the attractiveness of these women and almost sort of like fancying them, as it were. They also talk about these women appearing off stage. So they would have their own dressing room. They'd be mobbed by other POWs when they came off stage. Female impersonators also appeared at camp dances, at sewing and tea parties. And POWs reacted to them in different ways in terms of how they represent a sort of acceptable heterosexual behavior and unacceptable homosocial or homoerotic behavior. So I'll give you an example. Sergeant Major Andrew Warden, he was absolutely fine with female impersonators dressing up at camp dances. But in other camps, that wasn't acceptable. It was ruled out by authorities. But he took real issue when Angela offered herself up to be kissed by the highest bidder to raise money for the camp welfare fund. But other POWs were absolutely fine with this because it did raise a lot of money. And it struck me that the boundaries between what was acceptable heterosexual behavior and what was deemed sort of unacceptable homoerotic behavior were not clear cut like they are today, where we have a very clear sort of binary divide and most people are divided either into heterosexual or homosexual. And I concluded that at the time of the Second World War, these divides were far more fluid than they are today.
And how did you find the men's accounts spoke to their families about this? Did they mention it, or did they was it very much a thing that only happened internally and wasn't spoken of?
No, it comes up a lot in letters. And that was why I also thought there's a different mentality happening from today's mentality around sexuality and sexual identity. They were readily saying in their letters to their wives how beautiful these women were. And there was no sort of that didn't raise a question, I don't think, in their minds or the minds of those at home, that this was sort of questioning their sexuality. That just didn't seem to be an issue like it might be today if a man says how attractive another man is when dressed up as a woman.
You also explore what has been called barbed wire disease, or what the men themselves call going round the bend.
When I set out to research British prisoners of war, I did not envisage writing an entire chapter on going round the bend or barbed wire disease. But when I started reading the diaries and letters, I was so struck by how often these men were writing about their concerns about their minds or the minds of their fellow POWs. And it's a difficult one to get a hold of, because none of the POWs in the sample I was looking at was clinically diagnosed with a mental illness. Nevertheless, they felt something very definite was happening to their minds in captivity. They had a variety of names to describe it. Barbed wire disease was one. Going round the bend was another. And I think that actually gained popularity in POW camps, because a lot of POWs write to their loved ones, we think we're going round the bend, as we say here. So they're sort of explaining this new term that's circulating. Others talk about the blues, Kriegi, Dulalilis, lots of different terms, different symptoms, fits of temper, poor concentration, memory loss. And these will come on in sort of bouts lasting a few days or up to a week. And also four imprisoned medical officers actually wrote up their findings on this mental state, this sort of mental disturbances that POWs were going through. And they theorized the different stages of the disturbances, concluding that, you know, POWs who were in captivity for years, none of them would be left untouched by this illness. And so I decided it deserved a chapter in its own right. And I also went to Geneva and looked at the records of the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Mixed Medical Commission, which were the people who assessed which POWs were allowed to be repatriated back to Britain. So 10,000 sick and wounded or protected personnel POWs were repatriated during the course of the war. These mixed medical commissions, when they visited POWs, were also identifying a very specific type of mental illness dependent upon the conditions of captivity arising amongst POWs.
Was this recognised, and what kind of support might have been there when they returned home?
What POWs were going through in captivity wasn't particularly well recognised at home. There was a concern, a great concern within the government, of how POWs would readjust to their freedom. But that concern was more prompted by the length of time they had been away from home, as opposed to what they had actually gone through in captivity. But the government did actually put on what I think is a very remarkable program for its time. It set up 20 civil resettlement units for army POWs, and the RAF also set up four of its own for Air Force POWs. And these were units, residential units, where POWs could stay for up to 3 months, and they were designed for POWs after they had been demobilized but before they had entered civilian life. And they were to help POWs readjust to civilian life. They were places where there would be group discussions. They would have access to labor exchanges. They would be waited on in these units by members of the ATS, the Women's Branch of the British Army, to get them more used to sort of a mixed community. And the evaluation studies done on these units show they were incredibly successful. It was a small evaluation study, so we have to be careful with the results. But it showed that POWs who had attended civil resettlement units were much better adjusted than those who hadn't. But even more significantly, they showed a greater degree of cooperation and flexibility in their relationships than was normal for their civilian counterparts who hadn't been in captivity at all.
You also write in the book about your grandfather's own experiences as a prisoner of war. Perhaps you could tell us how that kind of introduced you to this topic.
My grandfather was captured on the 12th of June 1940, and he spent 5 years working on farms in Poland. And my parents, as I was growing up, my parents said that he never talked about the war because it was so awful for him, though he suffered so much. But after my grandmother died, he did open up a little bit more, and we get more and more snippets. And at that point, I started to encourage him to write a memoir because what he said was so interesting. And one day in autumn 2008, I was encouraging him to write his story. And he turned to me and said, "Why would I record my story? It would just be one long tale of humiliation." And I had never thought of it in that way. I had been proud of him and admired him for what he had endured and survived, and yet he was ashamed. And I wanted to understand things from his perspective. So I had a look at what had been written on captivity, and I couldn't find anything that really, for me, told me about the emotional experience of being a prisoner of war. There are great books out there that detail the activities that POWs got up to, the physical hardships they went through, what they were made to do, what working POWs were made to do by their German or Italian guards. But nothing that really put center stage that emotional experience. And so I realized I had stumbled across a PhD topic, and that became my book. My grandfather doesn't, though, feature in my book because he didn't keep a diary in captivity. We have, I think, about 5 of the letters he wrote. The rest got thrown out during a loft clear out. And I was really keen to just use diaries and letters and logbooks written at the time of captivity, because I wanted to get as close as possible to how POWs felt whilst they were behind barbed wire.
That was Claire Makepeace. Captives of War is out now, published by Cambridge University Press. And that's about it for today, but please do listen in on Thursday when we'll be exploring the history of crime in London.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.